Charles Edward O'Brien. The Argraphy Authority has been conducting a review of your case. Do you wish to add anything to the official record? No matter. Your correction is completed. You are free.
Free?
The crime of espionage requires a minimum of 15 cycles of correction. You've been here for 20. It's time for you to go.
Go? I can't leave. Where would I go to?
That's not my concern. Remove him. There. It's done.
Major.
It's me, Chief.
It can't be. It's been 20 years. You haven't changed at all.
Only a few hours have passed during your correction.
I don't understand.
Chief, I know this is going to be hard for you to accept. But you haven't been in prison. What you experienced was an artificial reality, an interactive program that created memories of things that never actually happened.
What?
The Major is correct. We punish our offenders by giving them memories of incarceration, modeled to fit each offender's personality. It's more efficient and much more effective than maintaining an extensive prison system.
Which means that what you think you experienced in prison, the things you remember, didn't happen. It wasn't real.
It's real to me, Major.
Yo, it's a, quote, traditional podcast, so you know you're getting an intro clip. This one is chilling. It's from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. As you've just listened, and to clarify, Chief O'Brien is unjustly convicted of espionage on the planet Argratha. Instead of incarcerating convicts, the Argrathi Correctional Facility implants them with memories of years of imprisonment in a few hours of actual time. O'Brien experiences 20 years in prison before his fellow officers can extract him from the situation. And then he must return and adjust to his normal life, which doesn't go well in the episode. Not at all.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
It jumped up a notch.
I said it was chilling because some tech startups today are developing this exact same technology. We'll save prison space and taxes by placing inmates in a digital correction center that makes seconds seem like years. What could possibly go wrong? Maybe that's what's wrong today. Forget Silicon Valley bros and their idiotic ideas. Maybe we're already living in a virtual reality prison manufactured by the Argons. Or maybe we're just avatars of our higher selves attempting to learn some lesson. Or we forgot it was a simulation in the first place.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad.
This explains why the mystic and the Gnostic, we of the broken places, know that time isn't flowing correctly, and matter isn't all that it's cracked up to be. There is a more authentic reality beyond our monkey senses, which we perceive here and there. Or maybe we're already trapped by Elon or Bezos in some digital penal colony, always reliving this disastrous 21st century.
Once again, things that could have been brought to my attention yesterday!
If any of this is remotely true, then it's good news, because you are here speculating about these possibilities. If you are aware, you intuitively know there is an answer. A way to break through the veil. On the other hand, you'll cope much better than O'Brien in Deep Space Nine because you are already filled with so much self-knowledge and artistic fire.
Satanic drones. where the Mystic swims. You're drowning. I'm swimming.
So welcome to Aeon Byte. We don't take prisoners, but liberate them. We are not the final authority on anything, but hope to be an endless possibility for everything, including getting out of this holographic Shawshank. We're running with those searching for the truth and avoiding those who have found it. We're writing our own gospel and living our own myth. My name is Miguel Connor, or at least his avatar, and I am honored to be with you as we break on to the other side, as Jim Morrison sang. All of us can find our true selves, the best version of ourselves, and all the manifest realities out there.
You know, we all must face reality now, sooner or later.
Well, I've wrestled with reality for 35 years, Doctor, and I'm happy to state I finally won out over it.
Tom Robbins wrote in Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, disbelief in magic can force a poor soul into believing in government and business. And you know what else? Believing in simulated realities. So let's tap into the sordid edge of two of the great magi of modernity, the Beast and the Swiss Magician, and how their work overlaps in ways that will bring clarity to your magical life. For this arcane jailbreaking, it's a pleasure to have David Shoemaker at the Virtual Alexandria. He will discuss his latest work, The Way of the Will, Thelema in Action. This excellent book, beyond connecting Jung and Crowley, provides useful spiritual and psychic exercises and fierce clarity on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life.
The word for the Garden of Eden, Kedem. Numerical translation, 144. Now the value of tree of knowledge, all right, in the garden, right? Eitz HaChayim, 233. 144, 233.
The Fibonacci sequence.
We could only do about an hour due to scheduling, and because, at the time, I had a killer sinus infection, and I'm still getting over it. And I was exhausted after visiting the Theosophical Society that day to prepare for the Astronosis Conference. Don't get me wrong, we hit all the big notes and critical insights. Yet as a bonus for all subs, let's continue to get Jungian on your ass. I'll include a past interview with Robin Robertson, focusing on his book on Jungian interpretations of the apocalypse. Since so many are worried today, as Western society collapses and the USA is in full trickster-slash-Hermes mode during the election season, the show's ideas on the end times will help you gain needed perspective. Get ready for Hopi Wisdom, the I Ching, Book of Job, and new angles on the Book of Revelation. And Robin provides some cool active imagination exercises, like his labyrinth ritual.
Some of you may die, but it's a sacrifice I am willing to make.
I've always contended that imagination is so important. It's a form of magic that David also addresses in his book. As Nietzsche said, no artist tolerates reality. And as the Cheshire Cat said in Alice in Wonderland, imagination is the only weapon in the war against reality. These are pivotal times, indeed. But with your artistic imagination and self-knowledge, you'll be fine, ready to pierce so many illusions and ignite your divine spark to lead the way for others. Time isn't flowing right. No one is coming to save you. You can't vote your way out of a problem. The end isn't the end, but the phoenix you've been waiting for all your life. It's gonna be fine. Go inward. That's where the treasure is. Create something new because, as Robert Anton Wilson said, reality is anything you can get away with. You're fine. There is nothing wrong with you. You just need to tap into your magic, which is ultimately your co-creative power with the cosmos.
Such a disappointment.
We can make anything we fancy in this arena of infinite promise. And this is what we come up with? Weapons? War? Surely we have more imagination than that.
Many still don't realize how powerful their minds are and how the Archons and Tech Bros use that very power against us. I've shown for years the power of the mind, from ancient tradition to modern studies. And here is another one for you, and thanks for it, Todd J. In his famous psychological study, Solomon Asch asked participants to choose the longest of four straws. Without fail, almost every participant chose the obviously longest straw. What happened next was inscrutable. When surrounded by a team of paid actors who insisted a shorter straw was the longest straw, almost 40% of participants changed their minds to fit in with the actors. See how easy it is to manipulate our minds into seeing a different reality? Collectively, humanity has been experiencing a false reality for millennia. Fooled by the Archons and tricked into supporting it together like an eternal herd.
A reality is just what we tell each other it is. Sane and insane could easily switch places if the insane were to become the majority. You would find yourself locked in a padded cell, wondering what happened to the world.
As Philip K. Dick wrote in Valis, we did not fall because of a moral error. We fell because of an intellectual error, that of taking the phenomenal world as real. Therefore, we are morally innocent. It is the Empire in its various disguised polyforms which tells us we have sinned.
I'm going to show you a world without sin.
Let us break through. Let us see through this digital penal colony. Let us finally meet our true selves. Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is.
Deja vu, right? Did you know hope and despair are nearly identical in code?
Now, my predecessor loved precision. His matrix was all fussy facts and equations. He hated the human mind. So he never bothered to realize that you don't give a shit about facts. It's all about fiction. The only world that matters is the one in here. And you people believe the craziest shit. Why? What validates and makes your fictions real? Feelings. You ever wonder why you have nightmares? Why your own brain tortures you? It's actually us maximizing your output.
Here's the thing about feelings. They're so much easier to control than facts.
Turns out in my matrix, the worse we treat you, the more we manipulate you, the more energy you produce. It's nuts.
I've been setting productivity records every year since I took over. And the best part, zero resistance. People stay in their pods,
happier than pigs in shit. The key to it all? You and her. Quietly yearning for what you don't have while dreading losing what you do. For 99.9% of your race, that is the definition of reality. Desire and fear, baby. Just give the people what they want, right?
This is the Aeon Byte interview, and with us we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. David Shoemaker to discuss his book, The Way of the Will, Thelema in Action. David, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us, too, we've got Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing today?
Doing very good, Miguel. Looking forward to hearing about, you know, Crowley and Gnosticism and Kabbalah and all that fun stuff.
Indeed, yes. One important message, different aspects of the divine. And David does an excellent job, not just with the parallels and how they flow into each other, but how to use these traditions as something useful in our daily lives, in our modern times, in 2024. So I enjoyed this book a lot, David, and I think it's an important book. But first of all, I have to ask this straight out of the gate. I was reading your acknowledgments. Of course, you mentioned Lon Milo Duquette. What would the magical world be without him? I shudder to ever think of that. I'm so glad. I think I've read 90% of his books, and it's made my life richer. But you mentioned Robert Fripp, the Robert Fripp?
Yeah, that's right. I had originally met Robert in 1985 when I was just a teenager, but I went to one of his guitar workshops in West Virginia, where he'd just started doing them at that point, and have remained, you know, a fan all those years, but kind of reconnected around 2014 with doing some more workshops. And yeah, so he's been an inspiration, and really, one of the forces that got me onto a spiritual path originally. It was not any intention of his or mine at the time, but as a teenager, going to those workshops and starting to do some basic meditation and starting to think more esoterically in terms of my inner life, really set me on a path, and just have very much valued the relationship over the years.
That's amazing. Yeah, of course, his guitar playing has changed my life many times and got me out out of some dark places, speaking of pure magic.
Sure.
So, as we were talking on the email, it's interesting because your book talks about Brian Eno and his oblique techniques, and I'm getting on this first draft of this David Bowie spiritual biography, and I was just finishing the chapter where they're doing the Berlin Trilogy, and Bowie's into the whole oblique strategies thing that really made this album come together. Why don't we start there? What can we learn from Brian Eno and his exercise? I know he would say basically every time you get these artists in a studio, no matter how talented they are, and you tell them, let's improvise and do something good, they all lean on the blues. It's like automatic. It's safe. And he wanted to break that down. So tell us about Brian Eno and how it can help us break our programming down.
Yeah, that's a great question. The mention of that, if I recall correctly, is in the chapter on creativity. And the idea is that we often get stagnant because we, as you say, we kind of fall back on whatever the life equivalent is of the easy guitar licks to play, you know, the things that are habits, the things that are don't require much thought, the things that are safe, the things that are habitual and instinctual, but don't challenge us and don't get us to think at our creative peak. And so what Eno is doing with oblique strategies along those lines was, for those who don't know the approach, it's these cards, and on each card is printed a statement that if you get to a stuck place in a session, would draw one, and it might say something like, do something blue, or think of an annoying thing and do it a lot. Something that just makes probably doesn't make any rational sense, but the idea is to put us in a place where we're challenged by the novelty of a situation and to go counter instinctually a little bit to shake it up. So I think in our everyday lives, if we could find a way to, you could even use oblique strategies, they're for sale on Eno's site, but do something that introjects or, you know, inserts a bit of uncertainty and spontaneity into the situation, and often we'll find that that can break us out. So one of the examples of that, a very simple example I give in the chapter, is just decide on a given day to make certain decisions without making decisions, to let some outside force make a decision. So where are you going to go to work today? Flip a coin and do what it says. Stuff like that, you know, simple stuff. But the bigger idea is to spur creativity with breaking out of habits.
Yeah, kind of break out of normative thinking. And I think David Bowie was very much into the cut-up technique, which he got from William Burroughs, where you cut up different lyrics and you just throw them together. And I find out, too, that
Stanley Kubrick was big into the cut up technique too.
I didn't know
People
that.
think he was a control freak, but he would go in one room and his other screenplay partner would go to another room, and they would come out and just throw it together. So
Interesting.
even Stanley Kubrick knew you couldn't trust the ego too much, right? Because again, we want to go with what's safe, which was
Sure.
formulaic. So.
Sure. Well, maybe he could still be a control freak by just insisting that his cutup was going to win the
Probably, yeah.
day.
But
Who
the fact
knows?
that he was, he was into the Dadaists and the absurdists and all those guys told you that he,
Sure.
as you write, you got to get into that font of creativity. And the mind is a trickster, and sometimes you got to trick the mind. Hermes is always never takes a day off. So,
That's right.
well, tell us about the book, The Way of the Will. Can we say this is a sequel to Living Thelema, or how did your book come about?
I keep describing it as sort of a sequel in the sense that a few of the chapters grew out of podcast episodes from the Living Thelema podcast, which has that in common with Living Thelema, the book, which came out originally in 2013 and Wiser is re-released as of a couple years ago. So in Living Thelema, the idea was to get across much more foundational ideas in terms of Thelemic tradition. So basic concepts like, introducing the Kabbalistic tree of life, introducing the idea of true will and the holy guardian angel, and basic rituals like the pentagram and hexagram rituals and Lieber Resh, Fel Helios, and things like that. This book, while I think it is intended to be, and I think it still would be approachable for beginners, is, like Living Thelema, also very much keyed to more advanced practices. So both books really are designed to appeal to beginners or more advanced people, but this one I think is probably less of the foundational material and more moving on into other topic areas that aren't necessarily what people get right out of the gate typically. So things like an in-depth look at Kabbalistic psychology, an in-depth look at some of the more advanced meditations that Crowley writes about, like Lieber Thicharb and exploring past lives, Lieber Yod, which is advanced meditations and bringing your consciousness to a focal point, and things like that are less talked about and maybe less encountered by people in terms of the Crowley corpus.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. And yes, I mean, I've done at least probably 50 to 100 shows focusing on Crowley. And that includes so many of great minds today, like Lon Milo Duquette, Tobias Churton, Jason Louv. I mean, just wonderful people out there. They're not just great researchers, but they're also syncretic. And I've done even more shows on Jung. And this is, I would say, the best book of putting Jung and Crowley side by side, which is amazing because both of them didn't even know each other, or as far as we know, right, David? I mean, they never wrote about each other. They might have known each other, but they are very similar, aren't they?
I think they had very parallel paths. I know Crowley knew of Jung
Oh,
because he
really?
did very briefly address the work of Jung in an essay called An Improvement Upon Psychoanalysis. And in that, he compared Jung favorably to Freud in saying that whereas Freud put the sort of sex drive as the primal thing that leads to will, he says Jung got it right and put will as the primary thing that leads to the sex drive. Regardless of how one feels about that distinction, I think Crowley was writing that at a time that Jung had not done his most mature work. And so I don't think Crowley ever became aware of the full expanse of all the archetypal alchemical and the more mature work of Jung. And I've never seen Jung anywhere refer to Crowley. But I'm glad that you enjoyed this, the kind of the juxtaposition and exploring of the overlap of the work of Jung and Crowley, or just magic and Jungian psychology specifically,
Oh, it was
Kabbalah, and
wonderful. Yeah, it
it's been
was
a
wonderful.
passion of mine. It's how I got in the door with magic originally anyway, because I was in graduate school somewhat dissatisfied with the more materialistic behavioral kind of stuff that was widely taught in school in the 90s when I was getting my doctorate, and so I kind of created an independent study track of getting into more Jungian stuff, and then came across Israel Regardi, whose book The Middle Pillar was incredibly seminal for me in terms of exploring the overlap of Jung and the Tree of Life and Crowley's work. So that's how I found Crowley, and that's, you know, that took off from there.
And here you are. Yes. It seems to me Jung is more popular than ever, or more relevant than ever. Are you seeing that, David? I mean, people talk more and more about synchronicity, shadow work, archetypes in the occult, the New Age, even in Christian and Jewish and Muslim circles. So it seems that we need them a lot.
Yeah, I think that the initial Jungian boom, I guess, was probably the 1980s when you saw Joseph Campbell getting popular enough to be doing, you know, TV series interviews and things. And you saw books like Iron John from Robert Bly and Women Who Run with the Wolves from Estes. And then I think what's happened in the decades since then is that, like the shadow work and stuff like that, it's just become absorbed into more mainstream cultural understanding. So people will regularly come into my office now, and without me mentioning it at all, they start talking about dream work, shadow work, archetypes, you know. So clearly a much more sophisticated culture in terms of Jung's work than a few decades ago.
Yeah, for sure. I have some theories of why, but neither here nor there. So for example, you comparing Jung to Thelema or Crowley's ideas, you would place the Kabbalistic tree, that is the self itself, the Adam Kadmon, the primal man, the template for the divine human, son of man.
I think that the best way I've found to think about that is that the tree of life represents the complete human, from the most concrete human level to the most divine. It also represents the way the universe has been created and manifest, and it also therefore represents the path of initiation and mysticism, that what we would call the path of return. So it's a map of us, it's a map of the universe, and it's a map of our way back to full conscious awareness of our divine selves.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. And the shadow, as you write, that would be the Klipoth. Maybe explain a little how the Klipoth are the shadow side in Thelema. And I know people want to talk about the shadow, but the truth is most really don't want to face it. Like, nobody wants to face a Klipoth or an Archon or anything like that.
Exactly. Well, there's different ways that people conceptualize Klipothic, you know, the Klipoth, and I'm not assuming that my way is the right way, certainly I'm not trying to present this as Thelemic orthodoxy, but just my take on it. And what seems true and important to me is that any zone of consciousness, like any particular sphere on the tree of life, has an expression in fullness and a shadow expression. So for example, the one I often cite is that Tiferet in its fullness is an awakened spiritual consciousness, where it's the center of our spiritually mature soul, you know. That's a big attainment to get to that place. And the shadow side, therefore, is potentially like the spiritual vanity that can come from having an attainment. So the part of us that achieves knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, that's a legitimate thing to be happy about doing. But there's that other voice in there that says, you know, I'm pretty cool for having done that. You know, that guy over there, I don't think he's done that yet. So, you know. And so you can see how any idea, any attainment has its potential downfall that way.
No, it makes sense. And what about the, I want to bring up the idea of evil in Thelema. I love how you wrote, Crowley said evil is the, quote, sin of restricting the true will. And again, that goes kind of to Jung, because I think one time Jung said evil is just not being able to tell our stories, or The opposite of good is not evil, it's power. And remind me of Kafka, who said evil is anything that restricts, that limits you. So, and the Gnostics, of course, said evil is just ignorance, not having your eyes open to what's in front of you. So that's, tell us, that's a great idea on what evil is, right? What limits us.
Yeah, and it's akin to Crowley's definition of black magic, which is, black magic is something that is not in harmony with the will, you know, with the true will. And it's probably a good time to say a word or two more about true will for those who may not know the concept. In Philemic parlance, it means essentially the will of the divine self that flows through an individual. So there's a universal will that gets individualized in a person, and throughout their life, it's their basic nature, their way of being, their reason for being, not a single task to accomplish, but a way of living in the world. And so in order for magic to work well and not be, by Crowley's definition, black magic, it's, we need to be doing magic that honors our nature, that honors the true will, and therefore honors universal will and universal processes. It's like saying, I'm going to do magic by jumping in the river and aligning my magic with where the current's going, as opposed to, I want this thing that may or may not be related to my true will. And that's going to be like swimming upstream. So you want magic to work. If you want it to not be dispersive of your focus and distracting and probably ineffectual, then learn your true will and make magical choices in accordance with it. So the concept of evil, as I say, kind of aligns with that idea in that to consciously make choices against our true will really goes against laws of nature. It's like trying to get a tree to do something besides grow up toward the sun, you know,
right.
And it perverts what's supposed to be happening. And so I think it's an interesting concept.
No, it makes perfect sense and well said. So it's almost like, to me, I always think of true will as simply, what is my purpose? Like when I was younger, you brought up Joseph Campbell and he said, follow your bliss. I always thought, oh, that means I need to get off in some way, materialistic, emotionally, and doors will open. And then everybody's, oh, wait a second. Bliss is, he's talking about will, purpose.
Yeah.
What is, like you said, where am I supposed to flow when I trust in the universe and know it's going to take me where I'm the most useful and can reach my potential, right?
Right, exactly. And the usefulness is, I'm glad you brought that up, because think about an ecosystem in nature. You know, every plant and animal and rock, you know, everything has its place. And it is, by virtue of not having an ego to get in the way of that, you know, it is, every aspect of an ecosystem is in service to every other aspect. It's again, the laws of nature that these things work together to kind of find an equilibrium. And it's only humans who have the ego to get in the way and sort of say, this is just something I kind of want, you know, I don't know about true will, but I feel like doing this. And that's where people really get astray with understanding the true will concept, is it's not just what we want.
No. And the result, if you don't, is pain, disappointment. And then there's a sense of peace and dynamic energy. And it's a wonderful thing when we don't let our, again, trickster ego take over. So,
yeah. And the piece I didn't quite get to with that last statement was that service, you mentioned usefulness, and the way that when each of us does our true will, it's inherently an act of service, because that's what we're here to do. That's our nature. And much like the ecosystem, when you get a community of people, each attempting to live in accordance with their will and give others space to do the same, then everything has more opportunity for harmonious living.
Exactly. Yes, I often say, David, And we humans, Zeus didn't give us feathers. He didn't give us claws. He didn't give us all this cool stuff. We have to wait for Prometheus to give us that fire, but one of our greatest powers is our empathy and the fact we can help each other and create a really badass team to overcome what other animals overcome in nature. That's really what
Right.
makes us human, our ability to be useful to one another, learn from those who are older, and really grow and evolve. So it's not even mystical, right? It's evolutionary, as I tell
Yeah,
people.
yeah, yeah. Or it's both, maybe.
Both. Yeah, we the Corpus Hermeticus said, yeah, we build humans live in both worlds. So
Right.
it doesn't matter. And for the audience, could you briefly tell them what is Kabbalistic psychology?
Yeah, so the system of the Kabbalah itself, the Tree of Life, and all its sort of associated ideas has built into it a model of human consciousness that includes transpersonal, transrational, and divine aspects. So the understanding of what a human being even is requires, from a Kabbalistic point of view, requires an understanding that we have this divine seed within us, and that we are in fact fully divine beings, and that the obstacle is just getting our consciousness is the obstacle is renewing our conscious awareness of that divine status, as I said earlier. So Kabbalistic psychology describes the interplay between the various what are called parts of the soul. So there's the physical body. There's the animal soul, which is like the instincts and the drives and the sort of autonomic consciousness and all of that. And then there's the ruach, or the sort of the ego state, the waking self. And then there's neshama, which is the spiritual superconsciousness. So Kabbalistic psychology and the understanding of what the initiatory path on the Tree of Life even is. It has within it this idea of how do these parts interrelate? How do we enhance their ability to talk to each other, these parts of the soul? How do we open up our to give a couple examples, how do we enable our ego to have better management of the animal self? How do we get the ego to have better receptiveness to divine influence? And to me, it's just a fascinating and actually very intricate and nuanced model of psychology, more so than anything I encountered in my professional training. So I always, this is the first time I put this much about it in writing, and I'm actually pretty excited about that part of the book.
Oh yeah, it spoke to me, and I love how you related to the Sephiroth. For example, you write Malkuth is the body, Yesod is a personal unconscious, Geburah, Chesed, Tifereth, Hod, Netzach. That's the Jungian ego. And Chokmah, Bina, and Keter, that would be the collective unconscious slash the world of archetypes, right? So even from a Jungian perspective, you can really do a lot of good work there.
Oh yeah. And it allows for a little more scaffolding in terms of exploring those regions of the self as compared with just the global model of Jung, which is easy to kind of drown in because he's obviously a genius, but not the best at conveying practical steps for,
No.
working on certain things. At least not in writing. So I think this is a really useful way to almost an implementation of Jungian psychology, but through a Kabbalistic lens.
Yeah, for sure. I already found some usefulness to it. And you're right. Jung was the first one to write that his writing was very bulky and cumbersome. And I guess he also wasn't trying to create some religious movement. I'm sure you've heard of the famous quote, "Thank God I'm Jung and not a Jungian." It's tongue-in-cheek
Right,
quote. But he
right.
never said, "All right." He said, "All right, we've got 15 archetypes and four paths to individuation." He left it pretty open for his followers and people to add to it and renew it and tweak it. Do you see Crowley doing the same thing? Or do you think Thelema just has to do it? Like you said, it has to be a living religion that fits the era and the culture and everything else.
Well, I do think Crowley left behind us a bit more structure in the sense of, you know, like his original design for the system of AA, the initiatory order, that was his first sort of coming forth into the world with his own system after he left the Golden Dawn. I think he left us a good bit of structure on the how to do it while still leaving a lot of individual latitude. And certainly it's a living tradition. I talk about this all the time that we can't be calcified with the way things were left 120 years ago. You know, we have to always be open to new scientific awareness, new, the results that each individual magician and mystic gets in their own work and what they then bring when they're teaching someone else. And, you know, that's what a living tradition does.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, and of course there's always going to be tensions. I'm sure there's a fundamentalist dilemma, right? People who don't want to change and this has to be the same way. And the Gnostic mass will always have that certain things that we can't make it more, a little bit more female driven. You know what I mean?
Those things do get set in stone, and that's not everyone, of course. I mean, there's lots of variability and flexibility in certain people, but yeah, like any tradition, you get your fundamentalists, and I'm not a very good one.
Yeah, in Jungian circles, is the fundamentalists are the ones who are completely secular. It's like, don't bring up alchemy or Gnosticism or all this superstitious stuff. It's like, what are you talking about? You have to. He was a mystic. He saw God. He knew God. He had out of body experiences, visions, all that. So
right,
this is what the soul can do.
Yeah, I've often thought that's another parallel between the work of Crowley and Jung, and that Jung, as documented in the Red Book, for example, had all these early adulthood cosmic experiences, encounters with various beings that, as magicians, we might say were on the astral plane, or even his own HGA. And then the rest of his life was an effort to give that context to bring something to the world as he was making sense of his own inner experience. And I think that's very parallel to what Crowley did with his own reception of the Book of the Law, and then trying to give a context for that and bringing something to the world. So another very striking parallel between their paths, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. Graham, what do you think? Do you have a question or comment?
Actually, I do. I was going to say the first one is I have to 100% agree with him with Jung's wordiness. I've always described that as Jung had a rule of never use one word where two paragraphs can be found instead.
Yeah, I have the same. Gershom Scholem also drives me crazy. It's like three pages, just get to the point.
Yeah. And why have a footnote that is shorter than the page it's on? You'd have a footnote be longer.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And I agree. Jung is much more found and everywhere, you know, in modern society, except really the one place he cared about, which is in the ivory tower of the academy. Mm-hmm. He cared that he was perceived that he was a scientist and a rationalist. Yeah. And, you know, he'd think it's great that everybody else is there, but he'd be disappointed that the academy still just doesn't want to allow him or anybody to do with him in.
Yeah, I see that.
I was going to say, and I look forward to working through your book because, you know, some of my work in that area is I've worked linking the Kabbalistic tree of life with the chakra system from India. And I'm looking to see how I can make the connections through your ones. The one area that I have problems with this one, and again, I put this on me and not understanding it, is trying to apply the idea of true will, not being evil, with people like Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy, because there's a part of me that I have trouble seeing that they weren't trying to act within their nature as being horrible mass murderers. And I admit that I struggle with this, and maybe you can help me. Hey.
Yeah. 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 And the legitimate important questions, of course, the multi-leveled response there. First of all, from the standpoint of, what does a free society, a free, let's say, thelemic society do when there's a murderous killer running around within it? It has the right to take care of itself. It has the right to police itself. So a thelemic society might very well wonder if Jeffrey Dahmer's true will was to do this, but that doesn't mean the society can't act to keep its citizens safe. Crowley addresses this sort of thing in his essay called Duty, where we have a responsibility to each other and to a community. So it's certainly, I'm starting with this for a reason, which is it's certainly not the case that we say, oh, well, it must be his true will, so he can do whatever he wants. Of course not. You know, we have to take care of ourselves. Second thing is that I think we have to understand true will in the context of a fully functioning human consciousness. And I think some people, unfortunately, may be so damaged that they don't really have fully functioning human consciousness that are truly psychopathic without kind of all the cylinders firing. And I think we have to look at that as a different kind of case in terms of understanding how that human is functioning. But even with that, I think we have to consider that the universe is somewhat amoral, and perhaps entirely amoral, in the sense that right. A tree is a beautiful thing. If it falls on me, that feels evil. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say that tree is evil. I'm going to say, I really wish it hadn't fallen on me. You know? Similarly, we could be walking through the park on a beautiful day and nothing evil at all, right? But to the ant we just stepped on, it was the apocalypse, you know? Yeah. So are we evil, you know, or are we just nature, you know? So I think sometimes in society, we can point to someone who has clearly done cruel things and things we would never want to do ourselves or never want to have happen to anybody we care about. But I don't think we have the perspective to say what is big picture, good or evil in that sense. And we just do our best to mind our own business and take care of ourselves and our loved ones. And, you know, then the ultimate questions of someone else's true will are for the universe to answer, you know.
Thanks. It sounds like you're basically telling me that I was trying to fit a square peg into a round hole by applying true will to Dahmer and Bundy.
Fundamentally important questions for sure.
Oh yeah, no. I was struggling with it myself. I was just going to say one of the answers that I found that works for me when it comes to morality is I agree with you on its basis. We're living in an amoral world, but I kind of see it as humans are called to add a layer of morality on top
That's
of
right.
that. And if we don't, and it's a question of just what morality we're going to add, whether it's, you know, for the positive or for the negative.
Right. And I do think that when people legitimately approach the task of discovery of the true will, part of that path is uncovering our own blind spots, our own misguided preconceptions, our own biases, prejudices, baggage of all kinds. And therefore, when we're working, especially if we're working mindfully within a system like AA or Temple of the Silver Star, the order I administer, a big part of it is stripping away that stuff that can conceal or distort the true will. So by the time the influx of awareness of true will happens, a person has done a lot of work on themselves to enact that will with maximum consideration for the true wills of others. And that means I'm not going to choose to do something that would probably impair the true will of another unless I'm literally defending myself, you know? And so I do think that there's some prerequisites to advancement on the path that tends to weed out people who haven't worked on themselves very much psychologically.
Very true. Again, bring up Jung. If you bring out the only way to make the conscious, the unconscious conscious, you got to bring it out into the light. And until you do it, it will appear as fate and you will be trapped into some horrible complexes that some of them you'll do horrible things. So, it's definitely all out there.
Yeah, we project our own shadow stuff onto others and society or those other people that are bad, yeah, were the good ones.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure Jung would have had a field day with Ted and Budney and Jeffrey Dahmer.
And our present political climate. You know,
oh, my God. Yeah, he might have just said, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Some things might be beyond hope, but it is the age of the trickster. As I think it was Dennis Merritt. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's a Jungian therapist, and he talked about this is the age of Hermes. It's the only way we can keep our sanity today, because we are in a transition, and only Hermes as the archetype can guide us to the next level or incarnation of Western society. What do you think of that, David?
Well, I in terms of the idea of the Thelemic New Aeon, the archetype we focus more on is the archetype of Horus, or the Egyptian Ra or Kuit, of course, and the idea there is, I don't think it fits very well with it. Certainly in its original Egyptian context, you know, we'd be looking more at Thoth. Thoth is the equivalent of Hermes. But I think ultimately, and this is the non-fundamentalist in me coming out, I think ultimately we'd better be paying attention to all the sources of wisdom that we can access, and whether we conceive of those as gods or goddesses or just good ideas, you know, we need to be paying attention.
No, well said indeed. I mean, and there are many forces, and sometimes what archetype works through you. If you had to put Horus as an image of an archetype or an energy, where would you put him?
A lot of the time, Horus, Ra or Kuit, is considered sort of a solar or martial deity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Embodying a bit of both energies, so certainly a divinely inspiring, powerful source like the sun, but also a powerful source of change and transformation, sometimes radical, forceful transformation, like the martial force that we would associate with Gabora on the Tree of Life. So a little bit of both, I would say.
No, that makes sense. And speaking of Egyptian deities, You put for the audience, he has a beautiful poem on Nuit. Hopefully I'm pronouncing her name, Nuit. And you write about the connection of Nuit and surrender. And then you write, well, this is a word that is not popular in Thelemic circles. Why is that? We're just talking about letting go and the flow and what true will is. But still, I guess people are taking the whole Horus as a general too literally.
I think the obstacle to the idea of surrender is an ego obstacle, and that is often, you know, Thelemites are, and I admire this, Thelemites are by nature a little bit anti-authoritarian, or at least questionings of authority. And so surrender sounds a little passive, sounds a little sheep-like, I think, to people. But if what we recognize is that we're surrendering to the laws of nature, I keep using that term, but it mm-hmm. keeps occurring to me. What we're surrendering to is the universal will. What we're surrendering to is letting the ego realize it's not in the driver's seat. It's the deeper self that is. It's the HGA's will that needs to take precedence. And that's, you know, those seem like pretty important things.
Yeah, I would agree too. And I also love, you talk about whether to use invocation and evocation, and you write very well, if you want all for yourself to be more like the entity, invoke it. If, on the other hand, you want the entity to do your bidding and be an extension of yourself, evoke it. So a simple wisdom right there, huh?
Yeah, I think people sometimes get into trouble by invoking very partial or specific forces, and therefore making all of themselves more like the thing, when maybe that's not so desirable. I mean, if I have a pet, if I have a dog, and I want the dog to go help me hunt for rabbits or whatever, I don't want all of me to be the dog. I want the dog to do my bidding.
Right.
So I think people do something sometimes, they get into trouble doing the equivalent magically, where they want a goetic spirit to go do a task for them, but approach it more like they just going to let it kind of let it in and let it take them over. And then all of them becomes influenced by something which is very specific and not necessarily partaking of the best of all of the planes of existence. So I don't want to sound sort of puritanical about this. And there's all kinds of magic and all kinds of things that work for people. And ultimately, if it works for a person, then it works for a person.
Right.
But I think a good cautionary statement is, you know, unless you want all of you to be more like the thing, don't invoke it.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, good advice for sure. And I also like in one part, you advise this Crowley to, quote, inflame yourself in prayer. Mm-hmm. I love that one. Could you tell more about the audience? Get yourself in the mood. I mean, you talk, the Gnostic Mass starts way before the ceremony. So it's kind of like that preparation that the ancients did for mystery religions or magic. It could be months before you actually did the ceremony.
Yeah, so it's such an important thing to practice and strengthen the muscles of devotion, as I often describe them. So in order to ultimately attain knowledge and conversation in the Holy Guardian Angel, we need to get stronger at adoring things and loving things, desiring magical, mystical ends, practicing as the philosophers of AA does in that grade, practicing choosing a deity and constructing powerful invocations to it and developing devotional practices. So you're aligning the natural rising Kundalini force that you've been working on prior to this stage and aligning it with a particular devotional aim. And by practicing that and strengthening those muscles, then when it's time for your ultimate formal knowledge and conversation working, you've got the power and the ability to direct the power. And that's ultimately what devotion is, I think. So inflaming oneself in prayer can be done in simple ways every day as well. Like if one performs the Lesser Banishing Ritual, the pentagram, there are moments in there when, even though it's a simple daily sort of hygienic ritual, there's moments in there like feeling the presence of the archangels and being in awe of that, feeling the six-rayed star at the center of the self and being in awe of that and adoring the divine nature of that. So there's little moments in all kinds of daily rituals that can fire us up and, you know, as we said, and inflame us in devotion. Incredibly important practice.
I would agree. Yeah. And wonderfully said. And I guess going back to vocabulary, and I guess it should be mentioned because sometimes I get odd questions about it, but your holy guardian angel is safe to say, and I don't want to bring in Brian Eno and he starts throwing cards at me, but it's safe to say that he's our higher self, right?
I wouldn't use that correlation. I think that that's an understandable question. And in some places, some people, including Crowley occasionally, do make it sound like that. I think it's more useful to say that, especially in the aspiration stage of the path before we've actually, you know, approached K&C, to think of the HGA as an external personal God, really, that we need to learn how to listen to. And it will be speaking to us and us alone in language that is keyed to our true will. And our task is to get our head in the right place to hear it. We don't have to go somewhere else to find it. It doesn't live somewhere else. It's with us all the time. And it is like, in practice, it becomes a voice of deep spiritual conscience that we might internalize to the point where it feels like just that highest part of us, and we're taking action instinctively based on its commands. But my experience with the HGA and those of everyone I've talked to about their experiences suggests that the experience is not one of, oh, this is just like a deeper part of me. It really very often has that strong characteristic of I'm encountering an other.
Right. It has an ontology.
Yeah. And in varying degrees of interior versus exterior experience. So the good news, as I always say, is you don't have to know in advance whether it's just a part of you or the higher self or an external being of some kind, because when you get there, the only thing that matters will be your own experience with it. So you don't have to define that in advance, or especially don't let me or anyone else front load your approach or expectation based on what happened with them.
Oh, yeah, well said, then. Absolutely. I mean, I think even Jung, sometimes people were talking about, well, the archetypes are static, but he said they are quasi sentient. They can have an agenda. They are dynamic. It's again, Jung was always trying to make sure, let's not make it too cerebral. And I'm sure that's exactly what Crowley was said. It reminds me one time when people were talking to Jacques Vallée about UFOs and, well, what if they're just projections or they're in our heads? And he's like, well, you can ignore their ontology at your own risk. So one day you might be abducted, or they will change your world, or they'll change the entire world. So focus on the otherness that's out there. As we are getting towards the end of the interview, Graham, do you have any last questions or comments?
I just want to thank David for giving me some tasty cuds to chew and integrate during, after the show.
Well, happy to do so, and glad it was feeling useful.
It is a very useful book, and I highly recommend it. Well, to end, and I know there's so much more in your book, and you deal with this topic a lot, but for those of you who might be waiting to buy this book or watch your podcast, what advice do you have for them to find the right teacher in school, other than write you a $1 million check or something like that? That's first, but outside of
Well, yeah, I would never rule out that possibility, but
that.
the wire transfers are preferred, obviously. But there are many great teachers and many great schools out there. I can just vouch for the ones that I can vouch for. So you can find more information about Temple of the Silver Star at TOTSS.org. You can get to the AA at OneStarInsight.org. My personal professional practice is at dr-shoemaker.com, and I do coaching and therapy, of course.
You do online?
I do, yeah. So I could do coaching anywhere for people anywhere in the world. I don't become your spiritual teacher or something. This is professional coaching, but often I have a common language of seekers and Thelemites who want some life coaching. The Living Thelema YouTube channel and podcast is always out there, and all the previous episodes are archived. And finally, just want to put in a word that every other year we do a public Thelemic conference that is not based on any particular organization or doesn't require membership of anything. It's called ThelemaCon. And this year's edition is October 4, 5, 6 here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and online. So if anybody wants to learn more about Thelema, here's some great speakers, including myself, Richard Kaczynski, Lon Milo Duquette, and others. Go to thelemacon.org and check it out.
Wonderful. Yeah, we will certainly have it on the show notes. Well, I guess lastly, do you watch movies or TV or any movies or TVs that you like that say they get magic right? I mean, there's a Jack Parsons series I haven't watched because people told me it was just meh.
Yeah, that's exactly the one I was going to mention, because happily, I would say, there's a lot. A Thelemite or magician is probably never going to be fully satisfied with some TV or movie adaptation of that, But that said, in spite of all the silly stuff that they obviously did for sort of ratings, on the Jack Parsons show, Strange Angel. I think that when they talked about Thelema, like when you had a authority figure in the tradition talking about what Thelema is to somebody who on the show doesn't know what it is, most of the time they got it pretty close, and it was so refreshing to hear that as opposed to our laws do whatever you want, and that kind of focus, which just sustains those misconceptions. So I thought that was a pretty decently done show for an adaptation that we're always going to cringe at a little bit.
Oh, well, good deal. Good deal. Glad to see they are loyal out there. So awesome. Well, first I'd like to say, Graham, thanks for keeping us company and for the good questions.
Oh, always a pleasure. Always a blast. And I appreciate everything David brought to the table.
And so much more.
Thanks for having me. It was an enjoyable talk. Thanks to both of you.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. And for the audience, the book is The Way of the Will, Thelema in Action. And yes, beyond David's website, I will also have a link to the book. Check it out. Well, David, thank you very much, and good luck with your conference, your works, and all the magic you're putting out into the world to heal this universe.
Well, thank you very much. And best regards to both of you for your journey ahead and to all the listeners.
Thank you. And there you have it. David is so cool and full of useful sagacity. As mentioned in the intro, the Archons wouldn't allow a longer chat, even if I made sure we covered all the useful ground. So for Ah Yeah subs, get ready for a bonus with Robin Robertson, focusing on his book on Jungian interpretations of the apocalypse. Since so many are worried today as Western society collapses and the USA is in full trickster-slash-Hermes mode during the election season, the show's ideas on the end times will help you gain needed perspective. Get ready for Hopi wisdom, the I Ching, Book of Job, and new angles on the Book of Revelation. And Robin provides some cool active imagination exercises like his labyrinth ritual. You won't want to miss it. For everyone else, thanks for being on this dark odyssey through the gnashing rocks of orthodoxy. And please sub to support this Red Pill cafeteria. For all subs, let's go to the end of time with Jung and find out it's only the beginning of your journey of self-discovery.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.